The following lecture is provided by Biblical Training. The speaker is Dr. Timothy Tennant. More information is available at www.biblicaltraining.org.
Islam is a missionary religion. We have to address the question that many of you are already raising about how does Islam spread and what is the nature of that spread. In order to introduce this, I want to turn to a passage in the Quran, which is one you absolutely must be familiar with, because this is quoted by Muslims with extreme regularity. This is Surah 2, Ayah 256. In Surah 2, Ayah 256, it says, "There shall be no compulsion in religion." That phrase is extremely important in Muslim thought. There shall be no compulsion in religion. Now, this raises the question, what is the relationship between this so-called jihad and this kind of no compulsion idea? This is quoted often in order to distance Muslims from this kind of, a lot of it is stereotype, a lot of it is based on truth, but this kind of violent associations with the spread of Islam. How did Islam spread? Essentially, what's happened in the scholarship over the years is that the Western writers tended to emphasize the militaristic expansion of Islam. And people were given a choice: repent, pay the alms tax, or die. You know, end of story. So there was a very strident kind of jihad view of Islamic spread. The Muslim, on the other hand, tended to assume that everybody came to Islam with great peacefulness, and it was just, you know, this wonderful, you know, invitation, like a great Billy Graham crusade, you know, where you just come forward and take on the five pillars, etc. I'm quoting Abdullah Yusuf Ali, a Muslim scholar, who writes on this verse and says, "Compulsion is incompatible with the Islamic religion, because religion depends upon faith and will, and these will be meaningless if induced by force." That's pretty strong words, given the fact that you have the sword being brandished in a lot of Muslim history. And in the Quran itself, we already quoted the passage in the Quran about the lie in wait, you know, and ambush them, slay them, cut them down. These type passages right in the Quran. So we have to do a little more reflection on the nature of Islam as a missionary religion. I will be honest with you, I don't know that we can completely sort out the some of the tensions here. But I think the I think it's very, very difficult. I'll give you some examples of why I think it's difficult, and always to give a very clean answer to this question. But we want to ask the question, how does Islam spread? How did it spread? And what is the relationship between the jihad passages and the more calm missionary passages? To introduce that, I want to just make maybe a more general comment that, quoting Max Müller, a famous 19th century historian of religion, who defined a missionary religion in the following way. He says, "A missionary religion is one in which the spreading of the truth and conversion of unbelievers are raised to the rank of a sacred duty by the founder or their immediate successors." So he's defining a missionary religion as a religion which puts conversion as a high priority in the ministry of the, or an outreach of the religion. So according to this, he classifies both Christianity and Islam as missionary religions. He also classifies Buddhism as well, or Theravada Buddhism as well. That's another whole story which would take us a far afield. But I think all of us would be fair enough to say that we recognize that there is, among the monotheistic religions anyway, Islam and Christianity share a basic commitment to being a missionary religion, that is, to spread and proclaim the truth that one sees as universal. We all know that in the New Testament, Christ gave the Great Commission, in fact, Great Commissions in all the Gospels. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, for example, Mark 16. These are examples of Great Commissions found in the New Testament. The Quran likewise has what they would call essentially a Great Commission. And you'll find here on the handout this well-known passage in Surah 16, Ayah 125. Surah 16, Ayah 125. This passage is known as the Dava. And again, it's a very important passage. And this is another one of these passages which you must know. It's why we're devoting a whole lecture to discussing this passage in part, because this passage opens up, call men to the path of your Lord with wisdom and kindly exhortation. Reason with them in the most courteous manner. The Lord, your Lord best knows those who stray from his path and those who are rightly guided. That passage is quoted essentially as a Great Commission type passage by Muslims. Call men to the path of your Lord. Kindly exhort them. There's no hint of jihad in this type passage. So this is the problem that essentially we have here. On one hand, we have Surah 16, Ayah 125, and if you read Surah 42, Ayah 13 and 14, you have this kind of no compulsion, call men to the path type emphasis. On the other hand, the Quran also seems to teach as well the idea of jihad. And for example, in Surah 8, 38 and 39, in 47, Ayah 4, I'll read the Surah 8 passage, make war on them until idolatry is no more and Allah's religion reigns supreme. Surah 47, Ayah 4, when you meet the unbelievers on the battlefield, strike off their heads. And when you've laid them low, bind your captive firmly. In the Al-Tava, when the sacred months are over, slay the idolaters wherever you find them. Arrest them, besiege them, lie in ambush everywhere for them. If they repent and take to prayer and pay the alms tax, let them go their way. Allah is forgiving and merciful. Oh, that's a very difficult thing. Here on one hand, you're saying that, slay them, ambush them, kill them if they don't pay the alms tax. But if they do, Allah is forgiving and merciful, let them go. So this has created a tension in Islamic theology between these two ideals. They call the Dava and the Jihad. And there's been a ton of Islamic literature about the Jihad and Dava and how they relate to each other. And it's not a very easy issue. So what we're going to do briefly is simply summarize, one of the ways this is dealt with by Muslims. But just to quote for you, Anson Atterbury, well-known scholar on his book Islam in Africa, he tries to completely contrast Christian missionary practice with Islamic practice by saying that Islam was proselytism through conquest. Christianity was conquest through proselytism. Now, he is arguing that essentially Islam spread by saying, we'll give you the sword first, if you repent, okay, then you can proselytize. Christianity sought to win people to Christ, and through that, they overcame political rivals, like in the Roman Empire. I'm quoting him in this book. The Muslim is to go out to the infidel and press the claims of Muhammad. The infidel was under obligation to recognize and believe. If the believer should refuse, then came the forced choice: believe, pay tribute, or die. Okay, so we have the kind of the tension here between the Muslims who are saying historically it spread peacefully. You have the historical evidence of swords and major battles. You have in the Quran itself the passage which says no compulsion and kindly exhort, and yet you have them laying an ambush to kill people and besiege them, lop off their heads. We cannot accept, as a Muslim, we cannot accept, I'm speaking of Muslims here, we cannot accept as a Muslim that these passages are in conflict. That is, that there is contradictory, that Muhammad's just changing his mind. There's got to be a reconciliation. So how do the Muslims reconcile these two passages? How do they reconcile these two doctrines? What do you think? That is definitely an interpretation that many Muslims have put forward, that the jihad applies to infidels, unbelievers. The kind exhortation would apply to people that were at least monotheistic. Many Muslims don't agree with that point of view, but you're certainly right. That's one way. That is the other major way. That's the one that I have here. Is I would say the major one is that it's reconciled by saying there is a priority that you must always begin with the dua. You must put your kindly exhortation, no compulsion, foot forward first. But if they reject it, and again, they here would come back into your idea, because some would say it depends on who it is that rejects it, what the answer is next. But if they, certainly they mean the idolater, rejects it, then you would pronounce the jihad. In that case, you could actually have a combination of the two that you just said as well. Now, what I've done, I've chosen one of these, the reconciliation of dua and jihad, because I wanted to show you how the Muslims have their Quranic support for this. They quote four passages to support that the dua must precede the jihad. Now, of the four passages, the Surah 2, 190 and Surah 22:39, I think are extremely weak. I don't really see how you can read it. You're reading into it, I think. Surah 48:16 is a plausible interpretation, but the best of the four is Surah 60:7-9, and I'll let you read all the others, but let's look at the very best one, because that way we can know, well, if you buy that, then you can go and look at the others. If you don't even buy number four, there's no point looking up the others, because this is definitely the best of the four, and this is found in Surah 60, ayah 7-9. Okay, here we go. What do you think about this? Allah does not forbid you to be kind and equitable to those who have neither made war on your religion nor driven you from your homes. Allah loves the equitable, but He forbids you to make friends with those who have fought against you on account of your religion and driven you from your homes, and about others to do so. Those that make friends with them are wrongdoers. Now, this passage does make a distinction between two different kinds of people. The kind that are, you know, they want to fight with you, and those who don't want to fight with you, which again has been used to support the idea that you had. It's also been used to support the idea of saying that give them the opportunity to respond, to find out if they are prepared to make war with you. So essentially you would say, this is our message, as one Muslim scholar says it, anybody in a good will, with an open mind, will quickly see the truth of the Muslim message, and therefore explain it to them. If they accept it, great. If they don't, then you have the authority to pronounce a jihad on them. So essentially what you have is the basic point is the dua precedes the jihad. That's the basic pattern of this idea, that you first give them the call, and then you give them, if necessary, you pronounce war on them. But then this can be subdivided into two categories, possibly. Those who are prepared to accept Dhimmi status, for example, the monotheistic peoples, whatever, people of the book, who are prepared to live and cohabitate with the Muslims in a culture and, you know, all get on with their work, and the Jews with their work, because of their work, that it doesn't really mar the Muslim garment for other monotheistic peoples to be present. but you would be authorized to fight against people who are pagan or idolaters. So that is a possible variation of the basic theme, but the basic idea is that Dava, in either case, would precede the jihad. So the idea would be you cannot pronounce a jihad on anybody unless you first have given the opportunity to respond peacefully. Now the real question, of course, is whether or not that's what happened. Even if you accept that as the paradigm, and even if you accept that that is a legitimate paradigm, certainly in the Christian ethic, it's not legitimate to have any jihad of any kind, any time, regardless of people's rejection of the gospel. So even in their explanation of it, I have, even in their best explanation, I have problems theologically with the basic idea of what this kind of thing means. But accepting that, this is the Muslim idea, how did it happen and what is the point of this? Okay, I want to say that I spent a good bit of time in my own master's work looking at this question. I was studied under a scholar at Princeton University who's a well-known Islamicist. His name is John Ralph Willis, an African-American scholar and a brilliant guy. He didn't know much about modern-day Islam, but he knew a lot about Islam in the ancient world, and his main focus on pre-colonial Islam in Africa, actually. But he was very interested in this topic, and we discussed it quite a bit. And I think the more I studied this question, the more I came away saying this is a very, very complicated issue indeed. It is not as simple as one might expect. What I think history shows, as much best I can tell, is that the Muslims basically spread Islam through both ways throughout its history, the Dava and the Jihad. I don't think that this precedent of the Jihad after Dava, the priority of the Dava, is an argument that really holds water historically. But nor can you say that Islam spread peacefully, spread through the sword only in Africa. That's simply not true. It is also not true to say that Islam spread only through peaceful traders and marabouts. Basically, what happened when Islam landed, and this is a massive overview, but just in a general view of it, Islam landed in the African continent. And landed there actually in the year 700. Actually, it started to get there as early as 640. So it's very early on after the death of Muhammad. Muslims are arriving in Africa. They have major invasions that began in 700. Those are clearly military invasions. In that sense, those early military invasions of Africa are setting a very powerful precedent for this jihad idea. If you look at particularly the spread of Islam from the death of Muhammad in 632 to the Battle of Tours in 732, where Charles Martel stops the Muslims in the Battle of Tours in France, there's a ton of bloodshed that happens in that 100-year period. Now, this is called the Glorious 100 Years of Islam, because if you look at this may not be the best map. I'm just going to look at a map of the world. Let's have a better one. Okay, if you have Islam spreading, okay, here's Arabia, all right? So here's Islam spreading in a double pincher movement. You have Islam dramatically flowing out of Arabia, marching across Persia and into what is today Pakistan. But in those days was Sindh. This is the Indian subcontinent. This is all part of the continent at that point. So this becomes a major Muslim area. There's a major thrust eastward all the way to India. Eventually, the Muslims will eventually control India through the Sultanate. You have Muslims coming, invading across in North Africa, sweeping across Africa, coming across the Strait of Gibraltar into the Iberian Peninsula, which is today Spain and Portugal. They take over all of Spain and don't get expelled, by the way, until ironically, the year 1492, famous date in Western history, but that date is also important because that's the last of the Muslim were expelled from Spain. But they lost power by the 13th century, but nevertheless, they're there for a long time. So they take over Spain, they're stopped at the Battle of Tours in France. So you have this massive movement, both westward as well as eastward, in 100 years. And these are military maneuvers. The problem is that when you get into Africa, this is where it gets a little complicated. Because if you look at the story of just this kind of spread, yeah, there's a lot of swords being brandished. The problem is the Sahara Desert is right here. And the Sahara Desert cannot be crossed in the 7th century by armies. That's not technologically possible at that point because the desert's too vast. And so the discovery of the camel as a tool of trade is a huge breakthrough technologically. So what you eventually have developed are camels that can cross the Sahara Desert and bring a person safely through the Sahara. And they eventually mapped out a few oases and all this, and this happened. I'm almost tempted to tell you one of the other hadiths about Muhammad's friend selling somebody an extra thirsty camel, but I'll refrain. It's very interesting, the camel stories in the hadith. But anyway, they crossed over the Sahara, and so these people are not part of Muslim military machinery. These are just people trying to make money. They're there to trade. They're trading things they got from the Silk Route. Remember, we talked about the whole connection of the Silk Route with Arabia. So they are trading goods into, for the first time, there is contact between European civilization and black people groups in Africa. It's happening through this camel trade, long before Western traders and explorers were there. So meanwhile, there's this process. This is so slow. The Berber people groups and the indigenous peoples of northern Africa are slowly being Islamized. So they originally came to Islam through the sword. But their children are being brought up as Muslims. And so some of these begin to come down as peaceful traders and to sell goods and whatever else into sub-Saharan Africa. So that happens for another 400 years. You begin to eventually see Muslim groups spring up in sub-Saharan Africa that had no idea that Islam was a military force. And if you look at certain African countries among people groups and say, how did Islam start in this group? There are many examples where Islam did emerge in that group through peaceful means. So I think that's, again, another way you have the paradigms are busted a little bit. But then what would happen later is there were, in Mauritania and other places in Africa, they would set up these jihad centers to train people in the jihad. And they would go to these groups that had received Islam peacefully and say, your Islam is unorthodox. You're not practicing true Islam, because they'd only got it through traders. They didn't really have it exactly right. And there was breakdowns in the orthodoxy of their Islam. You're not practicing Islam according to the way that it was passed down in the Hadith. So what happened was they began to establish a jihad to attack these people and to force them to accept the true Islam. So these are Muslims being given the jihad. Now, this is unbelievable, because again, this breaks all the paradigms. This is not Muslims attacking other pagans or idolaters. These are Muslims attacking people who call themselves Muslims. So again, that's why this is such a cloudy picture. So you do have them attacking idolaters in North Africa. You have them attacking Muslims in South Africa or southern sub-Saharan Africa. You have them peacefully transmitting Islam through marabouts, these traders in sub-Saharan Africa. The Marabitan movement, which I don't know if I have. Yeah, I do. It's the fourth one on the lecture sheet there. The Marabitan movement is founded, was a movement founded by one of the caliphs, Umar, which we'll look at later, one of the successors of Muhammad. And it was founded, it was authorized by Umar, but founded by a Muslim who took his name, Yahya ibn Umar, who founded this center. These centers they called Ribats. And these are centers or fraternities, another translation of it, that would promote Islamic thought and thinking. And they would establish these on the coast of Mauritania. And they would essentially be recruiters for jihads. And this started basically a back to the Bible movement, but it was a back to the Quran movement. Get back to the Quran. And this became known as the Marabitan movement. This was a renewal movement within Islam. And they definitely launched jihads in sub-Saharan Africa, no doubt about it. Let me give you an example, though, that shows you how this story is so complicated. The Marabitan movement came into sub-Saharan Africa, and they, on the way down, they were resisted by a people group called the Sanaki. Now, the Sanaki is a very well-known people group in West Africa. These people were resisted. They said, we don't want you down here. You're outsiders. We don't want you in our area. So they said, okay, we have a problem here. These people are going to keep us from, you know, these are very strong revival, renewal movement people. So they said to Sanaki, basically, repent or you'll die. So they launched a jihad against the Sanaki, and they defeated them militarily, and they forced them by sword to accept Islam. The Sanaki become Muslim by force, and yet they themselves, later on, within a generation, are themselves peaceably transmitting Islam into further parts of sub-Saharan Africa. It's unbelievable. So the relationship between Dawa and Jihad are extremely complex in a place like Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. And therefore, the whole discussion about whether Islam spread by sword or by peaceful means is not an easy one to untangle, because some have tried to say, well, in these parts of the world, they did it by the sword. In these parts, they did not. But that, you can't do that either. Even in different parts of the world, you find definite differences in terms of how Islam spread. In many parts of the Muslim spread, when they got to places where they were prepared to fight in military ventures, they found people who already were Muslims. So it becomes a very entangled picture. I think, though, that the Muslims have definitely downplayed the militaristic side of things. And I think we have to be very fair at that point. And it's not politically correct among Muslim circles to talk about, you know, this whole repent or die motif. And they will be widely rejected. In fact, today, there are Muslim scholars who say, oh, the jihad, these pastors we looked at earlier, there is no contradiction between jihad and dawa. Because this is not a jihad against people militarily. This is a spiritual jihad. Because the word jihad means striving. It doesn't mean military event. It means striving. Striving after Allah. So what they're saying is this just means that you will make war against the infidelity in your heart. You'll make war against, these are modern interpretations of jihad that you read in Muslim commentaries. So this is in a sense, a revisionist history move. Granted, the Christian writers often did not want to acknowledge that anybody ever received Islam because they actually chose to do it. And that's not fair either. And so I think it's something you have to weigh the situation and be aware of the diversity in terms of how he came to Islam. And I think even in the modern world, there's not a lot of differences. There are many people out there who are calling themselves Muslims just because they were born in a certain part of the world, and it's culturally significant for them to call themselves a Muslim. There are others that are forced to be Muslims because their parents or their families say to them, if you do not, you will die. I mean, Saudi Arabia has non-conversion laws. If you convert from Islam in Saudi Arabia today, you can be killed. Even in India today, they have massive reconversion movements. They're trying to reconvert back to Islam in places where Muslims have come to Christ. So that whole jihad motif is still there. But to be fair, let's say it. There are people today around the world who have chosen. They've heard the Christian message. They've heard the Buddhist message. They've heard the Muslim message. And they have chosen to become Muslims. Now, there are reasons that we may not accept. And we don't believe they're theologically valid, perhaps. But they have, for whatever reason, they have, on their own volition, chosen to follow Islam. So I think even today, to caricature or to characterize how he will come to Islam is very, very difficult and problematic. So we will stop that at that point.
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 28428, Spokane, Washington, 99228, USA.